Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. One of my favorite places in California is Mono Lake, just off Highway 395 east of Yosemite National Park. It's a strange, stark landscape dominated by relatively recent volcanism, and the lake is a weird, alkali body of water with an equally strange ecosystem based on brine shrimp, flies, and amazing chemical rocks called tufa that form fairy-like castle structures on its shoreline. And overlooking it is the towering crest of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. At sunrise and sunset, it's one of the most photogenic places I've ever been to. Mark Twain famously wrote about Mono Lake in his book Roughing It, where he called it a solemn, silent, sailless sea. This lonely tenant of the loneliest spot on Earth is little graced with the picturesque. Well, I disagree with the picturesque part, but it is a stark landscape. Our guests are from the Mono Lake Committee, an environmental organization that works to conserve the lake, fighting for years against the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power that sought to divert the freshwater tributaries entering the lake. Later on in the show, we'll talk to the executive director of the Mono Lake Committee, Jeffrey McQuilkin, about the environmental battles for the lake, both historical and current. But first, let's visit with Nora Livingston. She's the Mono Lake Committee's lead naturalist guide, and we're going to learn more about the natural history of this strange and beautiful place. She joined us recently from her home in Lee Vining, California, on the shores of the lake. Nora Livingston, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start out with, for a lot of people maybe have never driven down 395 past Mono Lake. Give us a geographic point of view of where Mono Lake is located and what the terrain's like there in the Eastern Sierra.
If you look at a map of California, it's about 180 miles east of San Francisco as the crow flies on the same latitudinal parallel, but it's about 350 miles north of Los Angeles along that 395 corridor, and we're just tucked under the east side of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So on this side, the mountains are very steep, rugged slopes, cliff faces that are in stark contrast to the flatness of the Mono Basin. It kind of, the jagged mountains melt into a rolling sea of sagebrush with this vast blue expanse in the middle of it that is Mono Lake. So there are these ecosystems, very different ecosystems that are just kind of colliding at this edge of the mountains and the desert.
Yeah, and it's also just due east of Yosemite National Park.
Yep, the Yosemite Gate is just about 12 miles down the road, up the road from us here in Lee Vining, right next to Mono Lake.
Yeah, and you mentioned that landscape being, you know, so interesting, that the high alpine the sheer wall of Sierra granite there juxtaposed with that flat alkaline plain of Mono Lake. That's been used for a lot of interesting old Western movie sets.
Absolutely, yeah. High Plains Drifter was filmed there with Clint Eastwood. I was going to say Cliff, and that's wrong. Clint Eastwood, right, yeah. Along the shores of Mono Lake.
Yeah.
And a fun movie called A Fair Wind to Java, 1954, that actually used some of the islets in Mono Lake that are volcanoes themselves, but use them as fake volcanoes in the Javan Sea.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out.
It's pretty good.
So let's talk about prehistoric Mono Lake. How it's in this like closed basin where there's no outflow. How old is Mono Lake?
So the basin that it's in formed about 5 million years ago with various processes, volcanoes erupting, the basin dropping. We're on this edge of the Sierra escarpment, like I mentioned. At that point, the mountains were kind of low hills. They had been eroded away before the uplift of the Sierra. And though it formed 5 million years ago, the rest of the history is a little hazy, but we know that water has probably flowed through and pooled in the basin for at least 2 to 4 million years. But about 800,000 years ago, it became enclosed in the basin. So it became a terminal lake with no outlets, like you said.
And, you know, I was looking at it from on Google Maps, the satellite view, and you can see something interesting in that satellite view. You can see, like, the bathtub rings going way out there. It used to be a much bigger lake, didn't it?
It did, yeah. So when it was flowing out, sometimes to the south towards what we now call the Owens Valley, sometimes to the east, actually, towards the Walker Walker Lake over near Hawthorne. And then when it became enclosed, it has fluctuated greatly in the last 800,000 years. So you can see the lines that were kind of carved away as the lake kind of gently lapped, or in windy times, voraciously lapped away the sediment around the edge. And you can see these old lake levels the best just around, just right before the sun drops below the Sierra in the afternoons. And you can see the shadows of every line. It's a pretty incredible time to look out and really notice how much change this basin has seen.
Wow, it's like you can see literally back in time. Look at that and take yourself back to, you know, all those different lake levels and the change over time.
Absolutely. I love walking down from a higher elevation to the shore of the lake and going up and down a little bit more and then a little up and then down. It's like traveling through time.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Tell us about the water coming into the lake now. Like, what are the inflow creeks? What are the creeks that provide water into Mono Lake?
There are five tributary streams, and the largest of which is Rush Creek, which actually kind of absorbs two of the other creeks, Walker and Parker, before it flows into the lake right at the Rush Creek Delta, which is a fantastic place for birds to gather. And Levining Creek, so that's three of the creeks. Levining Creek is another larger creek that runs down the Tioga Pass, we call it Levining Canyon, but where you come down from Yosemite and flows out into the lake. And there's also Mill Creek, which is a little further north, and it comes out of Lundy Canyon and flows into the lake. And like we said before, there's no outlet, so water only leaves through evaporation or is lost to groundwater, but most of that leaves by evaporation.
Yeah, and then over this long period of time, that's led to some very interesting water chemistry there. And one of my favorite accounts of, you know, Mono Lake that I read many years ago and reread all the time was by Mark Twain in Roughing It, where he describes, I think, the story of a dog that had fleas and was all bitten up and jumped into the lake and had a pretty unpleasant experience. And then you could put your clothes and dip them in the water and take them out and they would be super clean. Tell us about the type of water that's in Mono Lake, because it's not like your average lake.
That is very true. Mark Twain was right when he said that it was bizarre and that the dog leapt out yelping, because it is, we call it a triple chemical lake, because it contains chlorides, carbonates, and sulfates. And it also is very alkaline, with a pH of 9.8, almost 10, which is really basic. And it burns when you have cuts or scrapes. But it's also really salty. So it has a salinity right now of about 80 grams of salt per liter of water, compared to the ocean, which is about 31.5 grams per liter. So it's about 2.5 times as salty as the ocean right now, as a result of hundreds of thousands of years of runoff from the mountains, basically coming down, trickling down, and dissolving salts and minerals, just trace amounts, and then depositing them in the lake. And because that water only leaves by evaporation, it leaves the salts and minerals in the lake. So there are traces of arsenic in the lake. There's borates in the lake, aside from the main chemicals of chloride, carbonate, and sulfates.
Yeah, you don't want to be dipping a cup in the water and drinking that.
Not so much. I have dreamt about, you know, making pretzels. It's very, since it has very, there's a lot of baking soda in the lake, right? And with pretzels, you boil them in a solution of baking soda and water to get that kind of pretzel taste. So I've always thought, oh, it might be a fun experiment, but it's pretty, pretty.
Maybe the arsenic on the arsenic's, you know, on top might not be a great, you know, seasoning.
Yeah. And you can swim in Mono Lake, even though it has all these different chemicals. You just don't want to stay in too long. So I typically will swim for maybe 20 minutes or so before I feel too salty and a little too stingy if you have any cuts or scrapes.
Yeah.
And it's the alkalinity makes the water really slippery when you touch it because it reacts with the lipids on the tips of your finger and in your skin. You have, you know, just fine lines and layers of fat that react with the alkalinity in the lake to kind of make soap.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could, you know, take a dilute vinegar shower right afterwards.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea. It's hard to wash off the Mono Lakeness with just water. And I can attest to Mark Twain's sentiment about washing your clothes in the water, because I found after guiding trips for weeks on end in the summer that my shirts, my like guide shirts, were getting a little grimy even after I washed them in regular laundry detergent. And so I took them down to the lake and kind of scrubbed them a little bit in the places like around my wrists where the sunscreen kind of collects dirt and all that. And I took pictures before and after. So I scrubbed them in Mono Lake. Then I threw them in the washing machine and they were way cleaner when they came out.
Wow.
But I think the salt is a little bit more damaging to clothes than you want.
Yeah, you might want it. Your clothes might not last the many years they should, but yeah. It is a testimony to what Twain was talking about. Okay, let's talk about it's hard to say my favorite thing about Mono Lake because there's so many, but the tufa towers. These are the most amazing structures. Could you describe to us what those are and how they form? Because they look like these little fairy castles all along the shoreline, especially there at the South Tufa Preserve area. Tell us about the tufa towers and how those come into existence.
Tufa towers are one of the main draws to Mono Lake, I think, because people come from all over and they've never seen anything like them. And I love that you said fairy castles, because that's a new description for me. And I kind of collect the things that people think they look like. There are these white and light gray towers that are kind of knobbly, and they almost look like they're like termite mounds, or some people say they kind of look like cauliflower tops. They rise up from the ground and now we can see them, and I'll explain why that is. But they actually grew underground and they're rocks that have grown. We don't often talk about geology that way as like a living growing thing, but tufa is actually the combination of two types of water that solidifies and turns into a rock. So we have fresh water that's flowing down underground from the mountains after it rains, as the snow melts, and it's picking up trace amounts of calcium that it dissolves as it flows down by gravity to the lake. And this area has lots of faults and geologic activity, earthquake activity, that has a lot of cracks underground. And so that fresh water actually pushes up underneath the lake through these gaps and fissures. And it interacts with the carbonate in the lake that's dissolved in the lake. And so the calcium and the carbonate, they glom onto each other and they form a solid. And then it's called precipitating out. And because the fresh water is less dense than the salt water, it floats to the top. So it slowly builds on top of itself until it reaches the surface of the water. And it's a little fragile at first, but then it hardens over time. And when the lake has dropped in recent years due to excessive water diversions to Los Angeles, but also in times of climate variance in the past, the lake drops and reveals these incredible towers that some of them are 20 plus feet tall. And there are ancient tufa towers as well from glacial times, hundreds of thousands of years old, tens of thousands of years old. And they are wider and more, trying to figure the best way to describe them, regal almost, yeah, as they stay much higher above the lake and tell us of times when the water was that high. But the tufa towers, especially in that south area of the lake, it's called South Tufa, and a lot of the water from the mountains is kind of funneled to that area, so we see a lot of tufa forming right there. And there are also a lot of great cracks, and you can follow the lines of tufa as they've continued to grow from these little cracks where the water comes up. Oh. And the towers are just so beautiful, but they're also very fragile. So we try to keep people from touching them too much or climbing on them or breaking off pieces to take home.
Yeah, because they're the big draw. They're the thing that photographers from around the world like to come and photograph it, especially like in the early morning light or the late evening as the sun's going down, when that warm light is hitting them. They just become magical. They look like something off a Roger Dean album cover from the 70s, progressive rock album cover. They're just incredible. You really feel like you're transported to another world when you're there in the tufa towers. They're interesting. They're a kind of limestone, a chemical rock, as it were.
Yes. Yeah, chemical rock. I like that.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at Mono Lake in Eastern California with Mono Lake Committee naturalist guide Nora Livingston. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our look at the strange, wonderful natural history of Mono Lake with naturalist and guide Nora Livingston.
Well, the lake is so unique, like I mentioned before. It's also quite large, so it's about twice the size of the city of San Francisco, which is pretty big. So it's 13 miles by about 9 miles wide, and or 9 miles tall. And it's too alkaline for fish to survive, but it is absolutely filled with other tiny creatures. Brine shrimp, which their scientific name for this specific species is Artemia monica, after Mono Lake, because it only lives in Mono Lake. And it's a tiny little fairy shrimp, so not the shrimp that you would eat at a restaurant, but tiny little shrimp with 22 little, well, we call them legs, but they're not really legs, that propel them through the water. They're about the length of my pinky nail, and about 7 trillion of them live in Mono Lake in the summer, and they forage on algae, microscopic algae, that is widespread throughout kind of the photo layer where the sun penetrates the lake, the top several feet, although it's been known that brine shrimp go down quite far sometimes. So there are just clouds of these incredible tiny shrimp. And then along the edge of the lake and by the tufa towers and floating on top of the lake are alkali flies. So this is a common species around saline lakes and alkaline soils, but there are trillions of them as well, and they coat the shorelines. And so you'll walk up and the whole shoreline will be black, and you'll see birds running through, especially the California gulls. They'll run through a cloud of flies with their eyes open, with their mouth open. They'll run through a cloud of flies with their mouth open, just vacuuming them up. So a quick snack for them. But the alkali flies also can scuba dive underneath the water. So they actually have little hairs on their body that they can collect a bubble of oxygen around themselves. So they look like this little silver bullet underneath the water, and they crawl around and they forage on algae underwater. They lay their eggs, and then they can just float up to the surface, pop that bubble, and fly off. Actually, Mark Twain said, as dry as an office patent report, which I think is pretty funny.
That's a great description. Yeah, well, he's what a great way with words and descriptions he had. And they're, like you said, you walk along and it just looks like there's like black stuff all along the shoreline. And then you get up close to it and they start flying away and you realize, oh my gosh, those are flies. And there's so many of them. And they also are just, like you said, such a rich food source. So let's go to the next amazing thing of so many about Mono Lake, the birds, because it's like you said, they're not the kind of shrimp you eat, but it's Mono Lake's a restaurant for birds.
Absolutely. Mono Lake is a big, thick bowl of healthy soup for millions of migratory birds that pass by and through the area. And many of them stay at the lake. They stage for their migration so that they can fill up on brine shrimp and alkali flies. The California gulls that I mentioned before, they actually nest on the islands in Mono Lake. And about 50,000 of them nest here and feed their chicks the most natural thing that they could, those brine shrimp and alkali flies. We think of gulls as kind of the rats of the sky. They're just seagulls. They steal hot dogs out of your hand. But the California gulls at Mono Lake truly have this absolute banquet of natural food for them to take back to their young. And the lake is also a staging area for Wilsons and red-necked phalaropes, who breed in the Arctic Circle up in Canada, and then fly down to Mono Lake to then double their body weight and get enough energy to molt their feathers and get ready for their 5,000-mile migration down to Argentina and Chile and the high-altitude saline lakes down there, where they get to spend their winter foraging alongside flamingos, which I've always wanted to see a flamingo, and now maybe I'll get to go visit the phalaropes that come to Mono Lake and stay over for a few weeks, see them with flamingos down south.
Yeah, tell them you're from the Mono Lake Committee and they'll put you up.
They'll know.
Put you up next to their nests, yeah.
There's another bird called the eared grebe, and they come later in the fall. Their migration's a little later than the phalaropes, and over a million eared grebes come to Mono Lake to just eat as much as they possibly can. And like the phalaropes, they'll double, sometimes even triple their body weight by eating the shrimp and flies. And then they have to take off to head south for the winter to go down to Baja California and Salton Sea, but they've eaten too much. So you see that they have to kind of run on the lake surface for a while, working out until they've lost a few ounces, and then they can actually take flight and take off. So without this lake here, those several species of birds in huge numbers wouldn't have their gas station to get them where they need to go for the winter. Wow. There aren't that many other lakes around that have the food source that they need.
Yeah. And you mentioned the gulls. Isn't it one of like the largest gull rookeries in California?
Yeah, absolutely. There's another large rookery actually in Utah at the Great Salt Lake. But the Mono Lake rookery colony is 50,000 or so gulls, and is, like I said, is like the perfect place for them to be. They're protected from predators by being on the island. They have just an abundance of food right at their bill tips to bring back to their growing young. And then they migrate over to the coast for the winter. So we actually don't see gulls here in the winter. And the brine shrimp and alkali flies are gone in the winter as well. They're dormant in the winter and algae kind of takes over. So
the gulls that we see on the California coast in the wintertime, wheeling over the waves, they're in Mono Lake in the summer.
Some of them, yeah. California gulls, almost all of them that we see on this coast are from Mono. And they mix in with some of the larger gulls that stay on the coast year-round, like the western gulls. But if you learn to tell them apart, you will be looking at a Mono Lake California gull.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, how about some of the other interesting wildlife? Because like you said, it sits in this, you know, incredible intersection between ecosystems where you've got the Sierra Nevada and, you know, Yosemite Park and that eastern slope of the Sierra and then the Great Basin. And to the south of you is Long Valley Caldera and that volcanic area. And to the north is Walker River and the Walker River Canyon. Tell us about some of the other interesting wildlife in that ecosystem there at Mono Lake.
Wildlife here is definitely abundant in species diversity, but many of them are very hard to see. So we have lots of small mammals like kangaroo rats and pygmy rabbits and jackrabbits. We actually see those quite frequently. But we also have things like gray foxes and skunks and raccoons and pine martens, or American pine martens is I believe what they're called now. We also have big megafauna like bighorn sheep are just in the Sierra above Mono Lake. And mountain lions are prevalent, but we rarely see them because they're so good at hiding. We, of course, have black bears that roam in the hills and sometimes will come down into the high desert down here in Lee Vining. And there's actually a great picture of a black bear running away from the lake. Like the lake is in the background and it was down there sniffing around. And then it kind of got spooked in the middle of the day and ran back into the sagebrush. So there's so much to see here. We also have bobcat and mule deer. And it's always exciting to head up into the Bodie Hills, which are just north of Mono Lake. They're kind of at the north boundary of the basin because there are antelope. Well, they're not true antelope. There are pronghorn in the Bodie Hills. And they have been known to come down and hang out in the sagebrush closer to the lake, which is amazing.
Well, we're about out of time for this segment, but I would like to know, you don't have to tell us exactly where, but do you have like a favorite secret place you like to go? And it's like when you really want to tune into the Mono Lake vibe, if you will, do you have like a favorite place you like to go?
There are several. I won't reveal my secrets, but they all involve the shore of the lake at sunset, because if you're in the right spot, and you're either right at the edge of the lake or slightly waded into the lake, you have the orange over the Sierra and to the west. And then you look to the east and the sky is blue and pink and it reflects down onto the water. So looking around, you can just see all the different colors that Mono Lake contains and reflects. And it is always soothing. And it reminds me how incredible this planet is and how important it is to protect, but also just connects me to the lake and reminds me how much I love it.
Nora, at some time I'd love to come down there and you can take me to one of your secret places and I won't tell anybody.
I will happily take you to them. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks so much for sharing your love and passion for Mono Lake and your knowledge base, because, you know, you are, you know, if I was to pick one person to take me for a walk around Mono Lake, you'd be it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. It's an incredible lifestyle to get to be here and to help teach others about Mono Lake and share this most magical place with as many people as we can so they can help take care of it.
thanks to our guest, Nora Livingston, naturalist guide for the Mono Lake Committee. When we come back, we'll talk to Jeffrey McQuilkin about the environmental issues that threaten the Mono Lake area in the past, present, and into the future. Stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom. You are listening to Blue Dot. We're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Jeffrey McQuilkin. Jeff is the executive director of the Mono Lake Committee and joins us to talk about the historical efforts to save Mono Lake, as well as the environmental impacts of water use and climate change confronting the lake's ecosystem now and into the future. McQuilkin joined us from his home in Lee Vining, California, on the shores of the Inland Saline Sea. Jeffrey McQuilkin, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd like to start out by asking you, for our listeners, what is the Mono Lake Committee?
Okay, great. The Mono Lake Committee is a nonprofit organization, and we're very grassroots, membership-based, and the committee's been around for over 40 years and got started when a group of scientists were doing studies at Mono Lake and really came to realize the dire impacts that excessive water diversions from the Mono Basin, from the tributary streams that feed Mono Lake, were having. Those water exports were going to the city of Los Angeles via the aqueduct that the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power runs. And they were causing the lake to go down. It lost half of its volume, doubled in salinity. Mono Lake's a salt lake. And it's a very unique ecosystem. And what they were able to see is if the pattern continued, there was going to be really an ecological collapse and the migratory birds that depend on Mono Lake and stream habitats and shoreline wetlands, all the things that are special about the area were in a dire strait. So they organized and tens of thousands of Californians rallied to say, hey, you know, we expect more here in California in terms of our environmental protection. We know cities need water. That's important too, but not at the expense of the destruction of Mono Lake. And so there were epic legal fights. There are Supreme Court precedents. There are collaborative working together. There's connections between people in Los Angeles and people up here all trying to make sure Mono Lake has a sustainable future. And we are here today still working on protection, restoration, a lot of education programs, and making sure good science happens out at the lake.
When we talk about Mono Lake and the city of Los Angeles is so intertwined in this, the Department of Water and Power, take us back to the origin of this, because it really started with the Owens Valley Aqueduct and them taking water from there. And then when did they set their sights on Mono Lake and why?
Yeah, that's right. So the aqueduct comes up out of LA and through the Mojave Desert, and the first intakes in the early 1900s were there at the Owens River and Owens Lake, which is a sister lake to Mono Lake, a salt lake, you know, 120 miles south of here. It dried up quite quickly and always served as a reminder of what could happen at Mono Lake. And I think the concept was there pretty early on to continue the aqueduct northward and capture additional water sources coming off the east side of the Sierra. And the extension, the so-called Mono Basin extension of the aqueduct, was built, you know, in the 1930s and started operation in 1941. That's when the first water was diverted from tributary streams that feed Mono Lake, and we're in our own closed watershed here. So that ran for, you know, about 30, 40 years until the committee was founded, but the scale of those impacts became more clear as the lake dropped precipitously. And about 20 miles of stream were entirely dried up, in fact, below these diversion points. Some people always ask, well, gosh, you know, why would the city want to take water out of Mono Lake? We know it's a salt lake and it's got
right.
Individual properties to it. And excellent point. They don't. The aqueduct engineers were clever in that regard. They were diverting these freshwater tributary streams on their way down from the melting snow fields high up in the Sierra and capturing that very clean and pure water and putting it in the aqueduct, but depriving Mono Lake of the inflow as a result.
Yeah. And who are some of the early characters in this fight? Because I seem to remember the name David Gaines quite well.
Absolutely. David Gaines and his wife, Sally, founders of the committee, along with sort of their collaborative, their group of scientists. But David really took a lead role in speaking up for the lake and being able to communicate about the impacts and the diversions we're having, but I think really frame that in terms of a question for all of California. You know, is this how we want to manage our water? And as a Southern Californian himself, I mean, the idea that urban areas need water, of course, has value to it. The question that I think he was really good at posing was, well, at what cost? And is there a more sustainable way to do these kind of things? And of course, you know, decades later and the way California approaches water now, you know, a lot of progress has been made on that. And Mono Lake is a real example of how LA's reduced its diversions and embraced the idea that water efficiency, water conservation, better use of water in a city can mean that the destruction of Mono Lake is not part of the urban supply.
When was like the first real victory? Was it in court? You know, what was the first point where the first major victory in this fight to save this lake?
David has passed away, but Sally is still our organization board chair, and she always tells a great story. She said, well, we were just scientists. We sort of thought, gosh, if you took your facts and you went down to LA and you sat down with the water and power leaders, they'd just go, oh, okay, we better change things. And so they, the first idea was, let's just go show our data, right? And surely everyone will see the concerns that we have. That didn't go so well. there was no change. So they pretty quickly reverted, had to go to legal challenges. And at Mono Lake, that led to a very significant early victory in 1983, which is the California Supreme Court public trust ruling, or the Mono Lake decision, as it's often known. And what that court decision said was that the public trust, or the obligation of the state to protect shared water assets like Mono Lake for all of us Californians, including future Californians, is a fundamental obligation. And that although allocating water for urban supply is an important use of water, destruction of the lake in the process showed that there had not been an adequate consideration of the public trust, of the public values of Mono Lake. And so the Supreme Court said, this allocation of water has got to change, and we've got to have the State Water Board, which is in charge of water licenses, figure out what that balance should be. As goes things legal, it was a momentous decision there in 1983, but not a lot changed on the ground as a result right away as this process got going. It was like, oh, okay, well, what would it take to protect the lake, and what, how do you consider this? And there were counter lawsuits that came after that, and so on and so forth. But it laid the groundwork for the state of California, the State Water Resources Control Board, in 1994, so a decade later, to change the water licenses that allow LA to operate the aqueduct in the Mono Basin and include provisions that protect Mono Lake by raising it to a long-term sustainable management level. While still providing some water supply to the city.
Yeah, I know. I can personally remember our family had property near Bishop, California, back in the 70s and 80s. And I can remember the alkali dust storms, you know, and all the adults, you know, I was a kid at the time talking about like, yeah, this is because they're taking the water away from Mono Lake and it's drying up and we're getting all these horrible alkali storms.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a great example that over time, the more you looked at what are the impacts, the more became apparent and that were actually quite serious. So, you know, for the committee's founders, they were generally speaking, you know, folks interested in birds and then hydrology and things. So that's where they started. But then you get to something like this air quality issue, and it's really quite significant and became a, you know, an important component of the fight over Mono Lake and protection, as well as Owens Lake, which had so much water removed from the Owens River that Owens Lake is essentially, you know, was gone, but its dry lake bed remained, and those big dust storms were blowing up off of Owens Lake and were a big obligation of the, you know, they're a result of water diversion. So, you know, Owens Lake is about 100 square miles of lake bed, and Mono Lake has, you know, tens of square miles of dust producing exposed lake bed. It's a big deal. And between the two of them, we've been the worst source of particulate air pollution in the United States for decades. That's how serious the problem. The problem is when the wind blows and these lake beds start blowing up into the air and causing dust storms.
Yeah, and you always think of the Eastern Sierra area there, that Highway 395 corridor. It's just this pristine, wonderful outdoor recreation land. But that's amazing. I knew it was bad, but I didn't realize it was that bad.
It's wonderful on most days, right? And then, but you pick the windy day, and no,
it's bad.
Yeah, and everything changes.
Oh boy. Okay, well, before we get into some of the challenges that are facing Mono Lake now and in the future, what are some of the successes that you've had with the city of Los Angeles, and you know, with what's going on like right now?
You know, I think one of the great things about the Mono Lake story is it is about people coming together and saying, you know, protecting our natural areas is important to all of us. And at Mono Lake, there's a real connection of, you know, people statewide, nationwide, worldwide who thought, you know, visited Mono Lake and said, you know, this is a spectacular place, or they're, you know, they're bird enthusiasts, bird watchers, and they're going, oh my gosh, you know, the value of this as a migratory bird habitat. You know, is so critical. Might be fishermen, you know, looking at the streams and thinking about the, you know, the trout fisheries and the tributary streams. But it's also people in LA, and some of those fall into those categories, and some of them are just folks who, you know, live in LA and say, I want a responsible, sustainable water supply feeding my city. And, you know, it's been great to work with a variety of groups, and we have a, you know, really wonderful education program that we do in partnership with community groups and school groups down in Los Angeles, and, you know, bringing all kinds of folks up to learn more about their watershed and where their water comes from. And, you know, in some cases, like with Homeboy Industries we work with down there, you know, they're running really great sort of life skills programs and gang recovery programs, all kinds of things. And Mono Lake is like a part of the urban matrix in the city. And having those relationships and connections is really, you know, a special thing about this area. Even though we've got a couple hundred miles between us, Mono Lake speaks to everybody and is an important part of, you know, the future and kind of how people see themselves and their water supply in California.
Yeah, and LA has, you know, historically had a really bad reputation as a place of, you know, water waste with, you know, swimming pools and movie stars and you know, and people washing their cars and, you know, just not even thinking about where that water comes from. But really, it seems like Los Angeles is doing a much better job of water conservation than many areas of California.
They are, and they deserve credit for that. Yeah. You know, the early pitch for protecting Mono Lake was you could, you know, hey, city of Los Angeles, you could easily conserve enough water to offset a reduction in your Mono Lake damaging diversions. Yeah, that wasn't very well received at the time. I'd say it took, you know, again, it kind of took citizens, it took outside pressure to bring that conservation interest to bear, but the city has, the Department of Water and Power has really rolled it out in recent decades, and they are very water efficient on the urban use, and they've been doing a number of good programs and in terms of reducing outdoor water use. And the mayor in particular has set some very visionary and aggressive goals. I mean, they're looking at recycling, recycled water infrastructure that could recycle everything that goes through the major sewage treatment plant in Los Angeles. And it would provide, you know, hundreds of thousands of acre feet of water, which is just a tremendous supply for the city. So I think the Mulholland idea was there's not enough water here. We have to go all over the place and bring it down in aqueducts.
Right.
And the modern idea is we need a little bit of that, but we can recycle, we can, you know, be efficient and without taking away from the quality of life, you know, use far less on a per person basis and be much more efficient with it. So
A big win.
It's a big win.
Okay, well, let's talk about what are some of the challenges facing the area today? Because I've seen there's, you know, lots of proposals for development and things like that going on. So what are some of the big issues you're dealing with right now?
Yeah, we, as an organization, had a moment there in the late 90s where this big state decision came down and said, you know, Mono Lake has to be managed at a sustainable level, and sort of think like, hey, that's what we're all about. That's good, right? Maybe our work here is done. And the first and the, you know, the longest running thing we realized is, well, you know, this is a fantastic decision written in words on many pieces of paper, but turning that into reality on the ground is a political action. It's a hands-on action in terms of restoration projects, and it's something that needs a lot of persistence. And so, here we are, you know, 27 years later, and parts of that have gone well with restoration. Other parts, you know, I was talking to our attorneys this morning about recent correspondence from the Department of Water and Power. So, you know, what does it mean? If you want to make sure Mono Lake is protected, you have to stay vigilant. That's the takeaway. And so that's a big part of what we do, wherever that takes us in the water management picture. And we've learned some things about, you know, Mono Lake and its path to the management level that I'll maybe come back to. But the, you know, and then we also found all the rest of the challenges out there in resource management also apply at Mono Lake. It could be, land development, inappropriate land development. It could be, you know, the rising number of folks who want to come here and experience Mono Lake, which is fantastic, but how do you develop recreation sites so that you do that with the least impact? How do you provide education programs so people can really learn about the area? Things like that as well. So we, if it involves Mono Lake or the tributary streams, we are interested in making sure good outcomes happen.
Yeah, well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, looking forward into the future, what would you, you know, most like to see for like the next generation of the protectors and people who are living near and or, you know, depending on the resources of Mono Lake and its basin?
Well, of course, we really just want to share all the wonderful things here, whether it's the migratory, you know, birds, the phalaropes that are here before taking off on their 3,000-mile journey down to South America, and then their, you know, their annual patterns, you know, the beautiful scenery, the tufa towers. You know, we love sharing all that because I think it inspires, you know, the next generations to become lake advocates and lake protectors. I think for us right now too, you know, the lake is not up at that management level that was set a quarter century ago. And, you know, that raises some questions of science and hydrology and climate change that we're studying carefully. And we want to make sure the right policies are in place so that we that goal is gets achieved and we know we're on track to achieve it. So that's some work to be done as well.
And lastly, for you personally, what do you most enjoy about your work and perhaps just about Mono Lake in general?
You know, it brings together so many interesting people and so many enthusiastic people. So sometimes it's you might be talking to, you know, lawyers about the legal precedent set at Mono Lake. Other times it's the scientists, you know, who are excited about the birds. But, you know, just recently NASA landed a rover on Mars, right? And, you know, prototypes of that rover, they brought it up to Mono Lake to see if it could drill into tufa towers, because that's the kind of substrate that might find, you know, fossilized microbial life there on Mars. So there's just always something interesting and different happening at Mono Lake, and Mono Lake kind of brings people together and makes it happen. So it's fun to see, you know, what adventure comes next as the years go by here.
Yeah, I bet it must be fun for you too. Like, you know, sometime if you get somebody from Los Angeles, perhaps, or wherever, who's never seen Mono Lake before, and to kind of get to show it to them and see it for the first time through their eyes.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's great. And I've been here for a while, and those kind of visits are rejuvenating, because, you know, I've been to a few of these spots, you know, many times, and it can just be, you know, kind of renew you and get you excited about Mono Lake all over again, especially going with someone who's seeing it for the first time. It's always exciting.
Well, Jeffrey McQuilkin, Executive Director of the Mono Lake Committee, thanks for spending the time with us and explaining the past and present environmental issues at Mono Lake to us.
This has been fun. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Mono Lake.
It's one of my favorite places on the planet. It's just an amazing place.
Thanks again to our guests, naturalist Nora Livingston and Jeffrey McQuilkin, Executive Director of the Mono Lake Committee. You can learn more about the lake and the efforts to preserve it at monolake.org. And full disclosure, I am a longtime supporter of their efforts to protect this strange and fascinating place. So I say, long live Mono Lake. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.